Please turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 42. We're continuing this morning in our study together through the book of Genesis, and we arrive this morning at Genesis chapter 42. So after having spent three chapters on the trials of Joseph in Egypt, before telling of Joseph's deliverance, the narrator of Genesis spends three more chapters, Genesis 42, 43, and 44, on the trials of Joseph's brothers before telling of their deliverance. Roughly the same amount of scriptural real estate, in other words, is taken up with the brothers' efforts in the midst of affliction as was given to Joseph's efforts before in the midst of his slavery and imprisonment. Although we may be in a hurry to get through the narrative tension to the point of emotional relief when finally Joseph and his family are finally reunited and things obviously are sort of consummated, Moses, as the narrator, is clearly not in such a hurry. In fact, neither is Joseph himself, for that matter. He is the one who is purposely prolonging the suspense for his family for a period of time. As Joseph's family wrestles their way through their own set of trials, we glean some revealing and instructive points of both similarity and of contrast with Joseph's own chapters of suffering. While the brothers are remorseful concerning their past sins, we see both they and their father Jacob still have some growing up that they need to do, some maturing they need to do. And Joseph will be the wise and careful instrument of bringing that growth to pass. While Joseph will eventually confirm that the basic character of his brothers has changed from when they sold him into slavery, which is doubtless one of his chief motivations in testing them to see that their character has changed, we first do see some dramatic points of contrast with how Joseph dealt with the uncertainty and pain of his trials versus how his father and brothers handle their own set of challenges. And these points of contrast are especially displayed in Genesis 42, our text for today. Remember how Joseph displayed a remarkable faith in God, even though his circumstances seemed continually to be taking a downward trend? If you were just looking at it from his perspective, it seemed like oftentimes his life was in a nosedive. And even in the midst of just one terrifying, terrible circumstance after another, bringing him lower and lower and lower in his life circumstances, Joseph was faithful and Joseph trusted God. Every time Joseph, in the midst of his trials, opened his mouth in the narrative, it was to express loyalty to God, trust in what God was doing. Well, as we will see today in Genesis 42, Joseph's family responds to far less severe external circumstances with far less trust and strength, and therefore far less rest, far less peace than Joseph enjoyed it in the midst of his afflictions, which makes us as the readers ponder which situation has actually been worse, Joseph as a slave prisoner in Egypt or his family in relative freedom and prosperity, but loaded down with challenges, sins, doubts, fears. In Genesis 42, we are reminded that there are worse prisons than those by which others may constrain us. The worst kinds of prisons are those which we make for ourselves. When you are trusting God, when you are serving God with a clean conscience, as Joseph was, you can experience a deep contentment, a real joy, a lasting peace, even in the worst of circumstances. But if you allow superstition or real guilt of your real sins or anxiety over the future to control your life, then you will be in a dark, dungeon-like circumstance no matter what life brings your way. And we see this clearly in Genesis 42, this contrast. As we see, first of all, the problem of idolatry in verses 1 through 4. Secondly, the problem of guilt in verses 6 through 28. And then the problem of fear, finally, in verses 29 through 38. Interestingly, in each of these situations, just as in Joseph's situation, there is a real problem. There is a real danger. But the problem, the danger, is made much worse by the response and the hearts of those who are responding to it. And so let's begin by reading verses 1 through 4 of Genesis 42. Now, when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, remember, this is now after the period of famine. There have been 7 years of prosperity under Joseph's rule in Egypt, and they've been laying aside grain in Egypt under Joseph's careful stewardship. Now it's reached the point of famine, and it's all across the land, not just in Egypt. And so there's nothing to eat anywhere, including in Canaan. And now when Jacob saw that there was corn, though, in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, "Why do you look one upon another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die." And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob sent not with his brethren, for he said, "Lest peradventure mischief befall him." And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Not just in the land of Canaan, but including the land of Canaan. Now, in verses 1 and 2, there is a real external life-threatening situation. There is a real famine that is taking place. Jacob is not imagining danger where there is none, nor is he needlessly urgent when he urges his sons to make this journey down to Egypt post-haste and get some food. There is a famine. There is therefore no food, and therefore they are all in real danger. So that is all a real trial that they are going through. Jacob is not exaggerating then as he says, "Go to Egypt so we may live and not die." This is literally a life-threatening situation. However, as is often the case, this real trial also brings to light other real problems that are not directly connected with the famine itself at all. In verses 3 and 4, there is another real problem, but this one not external, this one internal. And this one not a famine, this one is a self-made problem. It's the problem of Jacob's idolatry. While the famine is real, not just an imagined danger, it is apparent that the famine and resulting challenges that Jacob is now facing, they just serve to flush out issues that have been haunting Jacob's family ever since Joseph left, it seems. Jacob has responded to the loss of his son Joseph by making an idol out of Joseph's brother Benjamin. Judah is not exaggerating. This is later on, a couple of chapters from now. Judah will not be exaggerating when he describes Jacob's relationship with Benjamin in this way in Genesis 44 and 30. His life, Jacob's life, is bound up in the boy's life. Jacob's life is tied inseparably to the life of Benjamin. He cannot live without Benjamin. That is a perfect description of an idol. Something you can't live without. And it's not God. Jacob is terrified above all else of losing his son Benjamin. Perhaps you know something of Jacob's struggle yourself. Rather than responding to loss or sorrow or pain in your life with trust in God's good purposes, you have instead clung all the more tightly to whatever or whoever God has not yet taken away from you. Because he's taken these things away, it just makes these other things all the more important and precious, vital to my life. And so there's a white knuckled grasp on those things or those people in your life. In fact, even just the possibility of further loss fills your heart with dread. Having experienced maybe financial hardship or financial loss before, you are now obsessive about ensuring your family's security. Not merely exercising responsible stewardship, but bordering on miserly hoarding. You are determined to be your own insurance policy. You know what it is to have suffered financial loss. You know what it is, perhaps even growing up, to have experienced financial difficulties or hardship. And so now you're determined that that will never come near your family. You will be your own insurance policy. Or having been hurt in relationships before, you now refuse to open yourself up to anyone. More than just guarding your heart wisely, you are determined not to depend on anyone else, no one else. Your happiness will not ever be tied up in another person again. You are closing yourself off from other people. You are determined to be, in other words, your own savior. Beware the tendency to respond to tragedy or hardship with idolatry, clinging even tighter to whatever you have left, even if it's just yourself. God will not allow any idol to stay undisturbed in your heart if you are one of his, because God knows that he has something infinitely better for you. He will give you more of himself, even if that means taking more away from you so that you can have him. It is no accident that Benjamin is exactly what God will require of Jacob. He will have to lose, Jacob will have to lose his idol in order to gain all the blessings God has in store for him. He will have to give up the very thing that his life is tied up in and that he cannot live without in order to be able to truly live. And so Jacob has responded to the loss of Joseph by gripping Benjamin. This must have been awkward for Benjamin, I dare say. And making Benjamin his everything. He has idolized Benjamin. But then we go on to see there is further problems in the family, and particularly with the brothers in verses 6 through 28. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, Whence come ye? And they said, From the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, You are spies, to see the nakedness of the land you are come. And they said unto him, Nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land you are come. And they said, Thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. And Joseph said unto them, That is it that I spake unto you, saying, You are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved, you'll be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and you shall be kept in prison that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And he put them all together into ward, into prison, 3 days. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If you be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses. But bring your youngest brother unto me, so shall your words be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. And they said one to another, we are verily guilty. We are truly guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. And he turned himself about from them and wept, and returned to them again, and communed with them, and took from them Simeon, and bound him before their eyes. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn, to restore every man's money into his sack, and to give him provision for the way, and thus did he unto them. And they laded their asses with the corn and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he spied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them. And they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God has done to us? In verse 6, we're reminded of the overarching power and wisdom of God, who gave Joseph a dream now over half his life ago, which is remarkable to think. The first dream that Joseph ever was mixed up with was his own, and it prophesied something concerning himself, that his family would eventually bow down to him. And now that exact thing seems to be unfolding. Joseph recognizes his brothers while they are understandably not able to recognize him. Think about this. Over 20 years has passed since Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers at age 17. Joseph is now almost 40 years old. Joseph has spent more time in Egypt now than he did in Canaan with his family. He's more Egyptian than he is Hebrew in a way. Joseph has now been ruler over Egypt for over 7 years. Joseph is arrayed in royal robes, probably shaven like a Pharaoh rather than bearded like a Hebrew. He's speaking Egyptian language through an interpreter to them, probably without any accent whatsoever, because this is his land. This is now his language. And honestly, who would ever even expect a boy sold into slavery in Canaan to now be ruling over the entire nation of Egypt? It wasn't even on the back burner of a possibility in their mind, so they weren't looking for him at all. Meanwhile, Joseph's brothers stand out like a sore thumb, right? They come in, specifically says, with all the others who are coming in for grain. But here are brothers out of a large family speaking Hebrew coming out of Canaan. And so he instantly recognizes them, but they have no idea that he is even still alive. And so they bow down to him. And in verse 9, we are specifically told that Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. In all the ups and downs of his life, and with his geographic separation then for years now from his family, Joseph must have wondered if this prophecy would ever come true. Yet, the dream has not completely been fulfilled, because the dream included his father Jacob and all his brothers bowing down to him. So Joseph sets about bringing the whole family back together, but in a fashion that requires some character growth on their part. Let me just do a little aside here. to a little apology for Joseph, because I think some, in fact, I know some commentaries and probably some of you are a little struggling with Joseph's harsh treatment of his brothers through this episode. But let me remind you of a similar kind of episode. And in fact, it was another king, another ruler. His name was Solomon. And he had two women come in front of him, and they were arguing over a baby. And they were claiming, each of them, that this baby was their baby. And Solomon, acting very wisely and for their good and for the glory of God, carefully, thoughtfully treats the situation, but not in a way that initially looks loving. In fact, he commands that the baby be chopped in two. What? Are you a good ruler or a sadistic ruler? What is going on? But of course, this ends up being the seminal event in Solomon's kingship, that the news of this event spreads through the whole land and everybody becomes fearful of the wisdom of this man, Solomon, because in the threatening, he was able to bring out the hearts of the people involved and judge wisely. Well, similarly here, Joseph will, yes, use threatening as a ruler has a right to do, but in order to bring out the hearts of those involved. Joseph three times accuses his brothers of being spies, verses 9, 12, and 14. To defend themselves, the brothers desperately seek to flesh out their alibis. Oh, you're telling me that I am a spy? No. Let me fill in our backstory for you. No, we are not spies. We're a family. In fact, we're brothers. We have a father, and we even have another brother at home. No, you can see we're not mercenaries. We're not spies sent in from some other army. No, we're just a family. We're just a nice family who needs some food, and that's why we're here. It's interesting that his accusations against them flushes out the news of the father and brother whom he knows exist. You get the feeling that it is exactly what Joseph was steering them toward in order to bring the father and the youngest brother up as topics of conversation, in order to both test his brothers and bring his full brother Benjamin to Egypt. Joseph demands then that Simeon stay with him in Egypt and that his brothers retrieve Benjamin and bring him to Egypt as well. So Simeon is sort of the collateral that he's keeping, and he's saying, I'll let you go back with the grain that you're requesting and all this, but I want you to bring Benjamin back. And in order to make sure you do, I'm keeping one of your brothers here. Again, from the brothers' perspective, at least, there seems to be a real problem, a real threat. A mighty ruler has taken notice of them, and it seems to be that he is intent on doing them harm. But in verses 21 through 22, we gain keen insight into the tortured consciences of these brothers. Even though it has been 20 plus years since selling Joseph into slavery, when a seemingly totally unrelated trial comes along, I mean, there's no reason whatsoever to connect this with Joseph in their mind. They have no idea that this is Joseph in front of them. So this is a totally unrelated trial, yet 20 years later, when they go through a seemingly unrelated trial, they're immediately assuming it is because of their past sin that has come back to roost. They immediately assume this is payback. This is us getting what we deserve because of what we did wrong. One gets the impression, in other words, that they have responded to every trial in the past 20 years in similar fashion. This must be payback for selling Joseph into slavery. There's no reason why this particular trial would flush that out if it weren't already there, just simmering all the time. Something must be happening to us bad because we did this bad thing. The brothers' whole lives seem to be haunted by the specter of Joseph. They had already needlessly mentioned Joseph in verse 13 when listing the members of their family, ending with, "And one is no more." Why fill in that detail? It's not like that's in any way necessary for this governor to know that you had a brother that isn't there anymore. What good is that? What possible information could that bring to him that he wants to know? No, it's still there. They know that Joseph, it's on their consciences that this brother was there and is no more. Clearly, the brothers have already repented of the sin, and their character has significantly changed since those days. As we'll see, though they still have areas they need to grow in, but they remain daily tortured by the thought that they will forever be doing penance for their sin against Joseph. And in their brief conversation, unknowingly in front of Joseph, we get a feel for how guilty they truly are. You can actually begin to see why this haunts them. Reuben specifically mentions that Joseph had begged them for mercy. We didn't read that in the original narrative. We didn't know about this. But Reuben now reveals that Joseph had been begging them for mercy when they were throwing him in the pit and when they were selling him to others. He was saying, please don't do this. Please have mercy on me. And that they had actually seen Joseph's deep soul distress and had totally ignored his agony and his pleading, and they had sold Joseph anyway. I mean, just listening to it through Reuben's mouth, it is a pitiful scene to even imagine, much more so, of course, to have lived through. No wonder at mention of all this, Joseph immediately has to leave the room in order to weep. He has been living with the pain of this betrayal for 20 plus years. And here are the very ones who inflicted that pain, admitting their guilt and describing their actions as freshly as though it had happened yesterday. There are clearly still raw and deep cutting emotions on both sides, but here especially we get a glimpse into the burden of guilt under which these brothers have been laboring for over 20 years. Any trial that comes their way, this is their response. This must be because of what we did to Joseph. Remember how he cried out, how he screamed for help, how he begged us not to hurt him, not to throw him in the pit, not to sell him, and we just ignored him, and we actually sold him for money, and then put the money in our pockets, and then lied to our father. It's just there. It's just constantly under the surface for them. Perhaps you know something of their pain. Poor decisions, sinful decisions, terrible decisions made years ago, but the pain and the guilt of them still causes you to cringe today. You repented, yes. You're sorry that you did that. In fact, over and over and over again, you've repented in case that previous repentance wasn't thorough enough or wasn't good enough. You've repented for your wrong actions, but that doesn't bring the aborted baby back or undo your adulterous actions or bring your unbelieving children back to church. It doesn't. Those words that you spoke that forever severed a friendship cannot be taken back. The burden of past sins that you can't ever make right, you truly can't ever make right, can't ever undo. That's an unbearable burden. We see this plainly in the case of Joseph's brothers. In verses 25 through 28, Joseph commands their money to be put back in their packs. And when the brothers discover this on their way back home, their immediate response reveals their basic view of God. What is this that God has done to us? This is their view of God. God is just waiting to drop the hammer on us. Joseph's brothers are like many, actually, Christians still today. They've repented of their past sins. In fact, sometimes repent several times a day. But still can't seem to shake the feeling that God is against them, that God is out to get them. Every trial, every sorrow must be God getting even with me for my sinful past or for my sins today. Just yesterday, I heard a Christian say this: what did I do to deserve this? That question from the same comes from the same guilt burden under which Joseph's brothers daily labored. It is a question that assumes that God is somehow getting back at you for something you've done wrong. What did I do to deserve this? What is God doing to us? Joseph's brothers are viewing God and God's dealings with them through a guilt matrix. No matter what happens, no matter what challenges or difficulties they face, their guilt comes up immediately in their minds, and God must be dealing with them according to that guilt. They are viewing God and God's dealings with them through a guilt matrix rather than through a grace matrix. Because we are guilty of real sin, not imagined sin, we know this is real sin that we committed. Because we are guilty of real sin, God must be constantly against us, must be constantly looking for ways to punish and repay us for our sins. Now, in reality, of course, God is sovereignly at work in this situation, but in the exact opposite way that the brothers suspect. You see, God is working through a grace matrix. God is graciously delivering them by the very means of the person they dread. God is delivering them through the very circumstances they are convinced are against them. And at the very time they are convinced that things are going badly, that's when God is working for their greatest good. God is working through a grace matrix, but they are viewing all of their life through a guilt matrix. And so when something bad happens, they assume it must be God out to get them again. Back in Genesis 42, the return of their money into their sacks not only reveals this guilt matrix through which the brothers now view the whole world, but it serves as a test of their current character as well. And that's doubtless one of the reasons Joseph put the money back there. Has their character changed? Will they abandon Simeon since they now have the money back in their sack? So we have our money. All we lost really was Simeon. So should we go back for him, or should we just save our own skin? Should we not risk our own lives for Simeon's sake? And we will find out if that's the case. But then we find out that another problem is still to be unearthed. And it is the problem of fear in verses 29 through 38. And they came unto Jacob their father, unto the land of Canaan, and told him all that befell unto them, saying, the man who is the Lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. And we said unto him, we are true men. We are no spies. We be 12 men, sons of our father. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the country, said unto us, hereby shall I know that you are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me, and take food for the famine of your households, and be gone. And bring your youngest brother unto me. Then shall I know that you are no spies, but that you are true men. So will I deliver you your brother, and you shall traffic in the land. And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob their father said unto them, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and you will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which you go, then shall you bring my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. Now again, there is a real problem unfolding here for Jacob and his family. It's not as if all of this is just entirely imagined. There's a real trial that is pressing out of them their heart's issues. The famine is still on, and so that's a problem. And they really have gained the attention of a powerful ruler, and not in a good way. Their brother Joseph really is gone, and Simeon seems in real danger also. He really is in prison. In verse 36, what does Jacob mean when he says, "You," and he points at the brothers, "you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more." It may be that he suspects, after all these years, that there was a ruse behind the whole coat in blood that was presented to him. But he probably means the same thing here that he means by Simeon is no more. Jacob holds his sons responsible for these tragedies that have happened basically on their watch. And his response, therefore, is now you want to take Benjamin. So you've already bereaved me of two children. Under your watch, these kids were lost. You think I'm going to put another child under your care? Absolutely not. But in the midst of all this, it's impossible to miss Jacob's debilitating anxiety in this entire episode. And it comes not only from his idolatrizing of Benjamin, but also from an intensely self-centered worldview. In verse 36, he says, "You have bereaved me of my children." Not a sorrow for Joseph being torn by beasts. Not for Simeon, who's still sitting in Egyptian prison, alive. Not even really Benjamin's danger if he goes to Egypt, but rather a concern for how all this will affect Jacob, and has affected him. Not a sorrow for those who are actually affected most, but a sorrow for how those trials have affected him. Strange as it may sound to many of us as worriers, a root cause of debilitating anxiety is often selfishness, self-centeredness. We are usually not wringing our hands over whether Jesus will continue to build his church and advance his kingdom. We are not fundamentally concerned as worriers about whether God can or will bring glory to himself through the set of circumstances that we see. We are not worried about whether God's name will be hallowed or whether his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's not what we stay up worrying about usually. We are not warriors. We are worriers. And those are very different things. And that almost always means we have replaced God with ourselves at the center of the universe. Jacob was at the center of Jacob's fear. Joseph, Simeon, Benjamin, all the other brothers, they are just actors in a play that is all about Jacob. By the way, in case you didn't realize this morning, you are in the same position. You are all extras in the movie that I'm starring in. And not just you, but my family, too. They exist to support my leading role. Right? And not just my family, as a matter of fact, but even the strangers who I drove by on the way to church this morning, they didn't know it, but it's all about me. And so that's why I didn't ask myself when someone was maybe driving slowly in front of me, I wonder what's going on in their life. No, I laid on the horn and wondered, why do they not realize that this whole universe is about me? And so there's an anxiety that immediately comes up with all of this because people just won't fall in line. They just won't recognize that the world really is all about me. And therefore, anyone who doesn't play their part appropriately, who doesn't melt into the background of my story, Who has the nerve to cause me pain or discomfort? They're against me. And it's hard to direct a play while you're starring in it. You want to direct everything and everybody and tell everybody that I'm the star and you all need to fall in line. But it's hard to direct a play when you're starring in it. So I worry. I worry about how others might disappoint me or they might injure me. Or I worry how circumstances may conspire to rob me of the props in my play. All the things I enjoy, the clothes I'm wearing, the room I'm acting in. I don't want to lose my props. And so I become concerned. I worry. I am fearful. Jacob's world had come to revolve around Jacob. And so his world was filled with fear. Fear of what was happening or had happened and foreboding about what might happen. And this is how, and this is why in verse 36, Jacob concludes, all this has what? Come against me. It's all about me, really. And it's all against me. That ruler in Egypt, he doesn't know that the universe is all about me. And Joseph, torn by animals, he didn't realize it was all about me either. And Simeon sitting in prison so that I could get grain to eat, it was all about me. Simeon, you didn't understand. That's causing me grief that you're in prison. This is all against me. Now, as the reader, it's hard not to laugh up our sleeve when we hear Jacob say this, though, isn't it? By this point, of course, we as readers know that Joseph is sitting on the throne in Egypt. We are, as it were, in on the private joke of the story. Jacob is the ruler. He's the one that's in control of all this that's going on. We can wink at each other. In other words, every time the brothers are afraid, isn't that cute? And we can, laugh at Jacob's pessimistic declaration that everything is working against him. And we can say, oh, he doesn't understand. He doesn't really know. He doesn't know the big picture. He doesn't know the real story. Joseph is on the throne. Unlike when we were reading about Joseph's trials for the first time and made to wonder, how is it all going to turn out for him? And we don't know. If we haven't read the story before, it looks like it's going really badly for Joseph before things finally turn around. It's not like that here. We already know, in a way, the secret behind the story. This time, we might even feel like we finally get to see life from God's perspective. What is there to worry about? Joseph's brothers? Why are you so concerned, Jacob? God has it all easily in hand. We can easily read through the story with that kind of attitude. But of course, Jacob is himself going through this trial exactly the same way Joseph went through his. And that is, he has no knowledge of what all is going on behind the scenes. So we should still be able to sympathize, still be able even to identify with the disquiet that Jacob and his sons feel. Imagine, in other words, if these three chapters had actually come before in the narrative of Genesis, before the three chapters telling of Joseph's trial and deliverance. What if these three chapters had come first and you're reading and all you know is that some really capricious, rough sounding ruler has got it in for Jacob and his sons and seems bent on causing them some pretty significant harm. I mean, that's exactly how we would read the story if we didn't already know that Joseph is on the throne. We would suspect that this family is about to be singled out for some serious pain and maybe even persecution. It does seem, from their perspective, very much like it did in Joseph's trials, that things are just going from bad to worse. That's what it feels like, and we can understand that, surely. So, in the concluding verses 37 and 38, we shouldn't have to strain too much as we read to put ourselves in the shoes of both Reuben and Jacob as they display their selfishness and their fear and their need for further growth. Surely we are not above those things ourselves. Verse 37, Reuben offers his two sons as collateral for Benjamin. Not exactly a selfless act, and so it doesn't instill any confidence in Jacob. It does not. It's very ineffective at calming Jacob's fears. You're willing to basically have both your sons die. Why would I put my son under your charge? In verse 38, Jacob is still centered on himself, though, and therefore still deeply fearful. What if harm were to come to Benjamin? That would bring sorrow to my old gray head. He's still selfish, still thinking about how all of this will affect him. And so, as we come to the end of Genesis 42, we want to zoom out for just a moment and get a little bit bigger perspective, even though it should be easy for us to identify with the challenges and the sin tendencies even that we see in Jacob and his sons. Throughout this 3-chapter section of Genesis that we've begun this morning, Joseph is going to be acting as a kind of sub-sovereign, an instrument of God who is using his power to accomplish God's purposes in the lives of Jacob and his other sons. And so let me ask you, can you see something of the love, in fact, of Joseph for his brothers? He has gone through much greater pain himself, and now out of love brings his brothers through challenges, yes, in order for them to ultimately be sanctified through the experience. Joseph's purposeful maneuvering of his brothers will test and will refine them. Are they the same selfish people who sold him years ago? He will not only discover that, but he will help them become better people than they were then. Will they treat their youngest brother Benjamin the same way they treated Joseph, just selling him down the river for their own sake? Will they look out for themselves, or will they be willing to sacrifice for one another? These are the things that the trial that Joseph is allowing in their life is going to flush out. Can you see the love behind the pain, in other words? And if you can, then let me ask, can you see the love of Jesus for you likewise? He has already gone through greater trial, greater pain than you will ever know. I mean, in fact, if you compare Joseph's trials to the trials that his brothers go through, it doesn't even compare, does it? Years and years and years in prison as a slave, and they are just having a tiny taste of the real sorrow that he experienced. And similarly, we will never know all the sorrow that Jesus bore for us. But now he, Jesus, as our loving and empathetic brother, does bring us through times of suffering in order to test and sanctify us. In fact, as we follow this episode in Genesis, it's hard not to think of Peter's assurance that he gives in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 5 through 7, when he says specifically to hurting, persecuted people who are believers in Christ, that you are kept. You don't feel like this. You're going through trials. You're being chased out of your home. You're hurting. You're being persecuted by unbelievers. You are kept right now by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. So you may now, if you could see it right, you may now, Peter says, greatly rejoice, even though now for a season, for a limited amount of time, if need be, you have to go through grievous and various trials. All this is so that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that's maybe being taken away from you and will perish, even though you are tested by fire, all this will be found in the end to the praise and the honor and the glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. When Joseph finally reveals himself to his father and his brothers, they will be able to see, looking back, all that he's been doing is for their own good, to test them, to mature them, to save them from the famine. Likewise, Peter says, at the final revelation of Jesus Christ, we will be able to see all our various trials occur because we needed them. We needed them. We were being refined. We were being matured by them. And in that day, we will praise and honor Jesus for his surpassing love and wisdom. Now, when we read this story, we know that Joseph is on the throne. And it changes how we read the story, doesn't it? Just when we read Joseph's story, it looks, we don't know where that's going, and it looks pretty bad, actually. But when we read the brother's story, we know Joseph is on the throne, so we're like, yeah, that's everything's okay, even though it does look scary, doesn't it? But we know we're adults, and we know these are just shadows. These are just bluffs. And yes, while we can understand that it might feel painful to go through it, we can see that Joseph is on the throne, so everything is all right. Can you see your life that way right now? Because that is why God not only wrote Genesis, but the rest of the Bible, so that you would see that Jesus is on the throne. And so that when you live your life, you can, as it were, read your life, feel your life, look at your life through this kind of lens, that you know that someone representing you is on the throne. And so, therefore, in the end, there is no need to fear. Will you trust Jesus with your life now, this day, rather than clinging to your idols, thinking, surely I cannot live without these things, rather than believing the lie that God is out to punish you for the sins you've already confessed to him, rather than living in the fear of trying to make the universe all about you, which is a terrible play to star in. As we all discover, my prayer is for you that as Peter urges us to, you will view life through this grace matrix of what God promises he has done for you, is doing for you right now, and will do for you through Jesus Christ. If you have come to see Jesus Christ as God's proof of grace toward you, that he is no longer dealing with you according to guilt, but grace. And that because Jesus is on the throne, everything is working for your good and his glory. We give you the opportunity to publicly profess Christ as we sing this song. May God bless you.